Big news! Wayfair's end of season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end of season savings, and it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's deep dive is one that I've been meaning to do for a while. A few years ago, we went to CrimeCon, and I actually had the privilege of meeting Jennifer Kessy's uncle, who was there at CrimeCon promoting a book that he wrote on his niece's disappearance. CrimeCon is actually coming up in September. I believe the dates are September 4th or 5th through the 7th. That first weekend in September, we're going to Denver. If you have a chance to go to CrimeCon, I do recommend it. You get a chance to meet so many amazing people, from true crime content creators to advocates for true crime, family members of pretty well-known victims in true crime. It's really a chance to just humanize this genre in general. And then, of course, you learn a lot of new things with all of the expos and different presentations and things like that. So if you get a chance to go to CrimeCon, it's in Denver, first weekend in September. We will be there. And if you do get to go, use the code MAMAMYSTERY for, I believe it's 10% off of your ticket. And lastly, before we dive in, make sure you're following Mama Mystery wherever you get your podcasts. It costs you nothing, but it just ensures that you don't miss future episodes. So with that out of the way, this is the disappearance of Jennifer Kessy. On the morning of January 24th, 2006, 24-year-old Jennifer Kessy failed to show up for work. Jennifer was a responsible young professional who really had it all. She had family, friends, a great job, and a loving boyfriend. She had actually just returned home from a very happy Caribbean vacation and settled back into her Orlando condo, ready for an ordinary Tuesday. But that day, Jennifer vanished without a trace, seemingly in the blink of an eye. When her concerned parents rushed to her condo, they found a pretty eerie scene of normalcy. Her makeup was on the counter. There was a damp shower towel. Clothes were laid out for work. Everything was in its place, except for Jennifer and her car. It truly looked as if she had just gotten ready, locked her door to head to work, and then vanished into thin air, as her mother would later put it. For nearly 2 decades, Jennifer's disappearance has haunted Orlando with more questions than answers. A grainy surveillance tape captured a mysterious figure parking her car, a so-called phantom suspect whose face was obscured by a gate. Extensive searches, media appeals, and exhaustive investigations have yet to bring Jennifer home. This case is as perplexing as it is heartbreaking, and in this episode, I will take you step by step through Jennifer's story, who she was, the baffling day that she disappeared, the twists and turns of the investigation, including the infamous CCTV footage and some new DNA clues, the leading theories about what might have happened, and the hard-fought efforts her family has made to find answers. But first, let's get to know Jennifer Kessy. Jennifer Joyce Kessy was born on May 20th, 1981, and she was raised by her parents, Drew and Joyce, in Tampa, Florida. From a young age, she was bright, ambitious, and full of life. Her mother, Joyce, later said that she really lit up the room. Everyone loved being around Jen. I know that sounds like a cliche saying, you know, to say that somebody lights up a room, but for Jennifer, she really just exuded that. She was glowing. She had this big, beautiful smile. I'm sure you've seen her face because this is a pretty well-known case. But if you're unfamiliar, check out the cover art to this episode and I will include her face on it. Now, Jennifer was known for her sense of humor and her responsible nature. She excelled in school, graduating with honors from the University of Central Florida in 2003. And by her early 20s, she was really thriving in her career. She had landed a position as a finance manager at Central Florida Investments, which is a timeshare company, and she earned pretty quick promotions. With her career taking off, Jennifer proudly bought her first home, a condo in the Mosaic at Millennia Complex in Orlando. And this is a big milestone. She was only 24 years old at the time and a homeowner of a beautiful condo in a gated community. In her personal life, Jennifer was extremely close with her family and her friends. She had a younger brother, Logan, and a tight-knit circle who spoke to her often. In fact, she was the type to call her mom or a friend anytime she felt uneasy. Like if she was walking to her car alone at night, she would call a friend. Her best friend, Lauren, actually recalled that Jennifer always carried pepper spray and stayed alert. She was safety conscious to a fault almost. She was very vigilant and careful. Now, at the time of her disappearance, Jennifer was in a serious long-distance relationship with her boyfriend, Rob Allen. Rob lived in Fort Lauderdale, a few hours away, but they were very much in love and they made the long distance work through constant communication. Despite the distance, they talked every day and they saw each other as often as possible. In late January 2006, the couple had just returned home from a romantic getaway to St. Croix that left Jennifer feeling like she was on a cloud, as she told her mom. The Kesey family felt confident that Jennifer's life in Orlando was on a happy, successful trajectory. But little did anyone know that her new dream condo would soon become the center of one of Florida's most perplexing mysteries. So let's go back to the days before she vanished. The lead up to Jennifer's disappearance really seemed entirely normal and even joyful. On Sunday, January 22nd, 2006, Jennifer and Rob returned from their vacation in the Virgin Islands. They had spent a wonderful long weekend together. Jennifer flew into Orlando and drove straight home to her condo, while Rob continued on to his place in Fort Lauderdale. That evening, Jennifer was in good spirits. She phoned her family to share all the exciting details about the trip. And the next day, Monday, January 23rd, Jennifer went back to work as usual. She put in a full day at her job and nothing seemed amiss. After work, she followed her routine of touching base with those who were closest to her. She spoke to her mom and her dad on the phone in the early evening, and then later that night, around 10 p.m., she talked to Rob before she went to bed. According to Rob, Jennifer was tired from travel and, of course, the first day back at work, but nothing was out of the ordinary. They chatted, they said their I love yous, and made plans to talk the next morning. But that 10 p.m. phone call on the 23rd was the last time anyone heard Jennifer's voice. Nothing about that Monday gave any hint of the tragedy that was about to unfold. Jennifer likely went through her usual nightly routine. She put on her pajamas, maybe watched some TV or read a book, and went to sleep in her own bed. She had even laid out some outfits on her bed, probably trying to decide what she was going to wear to work the next day. By all indications, Jennifer slept in her condo that night, woke up early on Tuesday the 24th to get ready for work, just as she did every day. She showered and she got dressed. Her damp towel and the clothes that were left on the floor suggest as much anyway. And she locked her door behind her sometime that morning. And that is where the mystery truly begins. Normally, Jennifer's routine would include giving Rob a quick call or a first text in the morning, like a simple good morning, as they each headed into work. But on that Tuesday, no such message ever came. By 8 a.m., as Rob was driving to his office, he noticed that Jennifer hadn't been in touch, which was unusual. So he tried calling her cell phone, and it went straight to voicemail, which immediately raised alarm bells. Jennifer was the kind of person who always kept her phone charged and would shoot a text if something was up. So Rob tried not to panic because obviously phones die or they get misplaced and there could be a benign explanation. But as the morning went on with no word from Jennifer, his worry only deepened. He called again late in the morning, still no answer, just voicemail. Meanwhile, Jennifer's boss in Ocoee, Florida, also found her absence to be alarming. She was always reliable and punctual, but that morning she didn't show up for an important 9 a.m. meeting, and she had never called in sick. So by 11 a.m., with still no sign of her, a manager from her work called Jennifer's parents just to ask if everything was okay. For Drew and Joyce Kessie, that call was like an anvil of dread. In that moment, Drew knew something was wrong immediately. Jennifer would never blow off work without any contact, and no one in the family had heard from her all day. Drew and Joyce's protective instincts really kicked into high gear, as it probably would for any parent, but by early afternoon, they jumped into their car and began the two-hour drive from Tampa to Orlando to check on their daughter. As they raced towards Jennifer's condo, they called hospitals, friends, anyone they could think of, hoping to find a benign explanation. But no one had seen or heard from Jennifer since the night before. Drew and Joyce arrived at Jennifer's condo in Orlando by late afternoon on January 24th. And what they found was really unsettling, though not in the way that one might expect, because there was no sign of a break-in or struggle inside of the unit. In fact, everything looked perfectly normal. The only thing missing from the condo were the essentials that Jennifer always took with her, like her purse, her keys, cell phone, her iPod, and then, of course, Jennifer herself. Notably, her black Chevy Malibu was also gone from its parking spot outside. There was absolutely no indication inside of the home of any confrontation, so it looked as if Jennifer had prepared for her day and headed out the door. Standing in that tidy, silent condo, the Kessie family knew that Jennifer had not just run off on her own. Something bad must have happened to her between locking her front door and getting into her car that morning. So within minutes, they called the Orlando police to report Jennifer missing. The clock had already been ticking for hours, and they feared that precious time had already been lost. Little did they know, though, that this was only the beginning of a long fight to just get authorities to take Jennifer's disappearance as seriously as they did. Orlando police officers arrived at the condo complex on the evening of January 24th, but to the family's dismay, the initial response was frustratingly lackadaisical. Because Jennifer was 24, she's considered an independent adult, and some officers kind of floated the idea that perhaps she had just taken off on her own for a bit. Maybe she had a fight with her boyfriend and just needed some space. According to Drew Kessie, one of the first responding officers glanced around and actually suggested out loud, "She probably had a fight with her boyfriend. She'll be back." Then, unbelievably, the officer left without even doing any kind of thorough search. This casual dismissal just infuriated Jennifer's family, who knew Jennifer and Rob had not fought, and that Jennifer would never just disappear without contacting somebody. In Drew's words, when those officers walked out that night without launching a proper investigation, he said that was Jennifer's last chance. He believed those early hours were critical and they had been squandered. The Kessie family was adamant that Jennifer was in danger, and they refused to accept a wait-and-see kind of approach. So they pushed back hard, insisting to police that this is completely out of character for Jennifer and that something was very wrong. They needed to do something. By nightfall on January 24th, thanks largely to the family's persistence, Orlando Police Department, or OPD, officially opened an investigation into Jennifer's disappearance, and the case soon shifted from a missing persons report to an all-hands search. Detectives, along with Jennifer's distraught family and friends, began canvassing the area around Jennifer's condo that night and in the days following. They went door to door at Mosaic at Millennia, the condo complex where she lived, asking neighbors if anyone had seen or heard anything unusual that morning. Hundreds of volunteers joined the search in the coming days. Strangers who heard about the case on the news showed up to help, passing out flyers and combing the surrounding fields and roadsides. The Kessie family, unwilling to just sit by helplessly, contacted local media outlets immediately. Within 24 hours of Jennifer going missing, her face and story were on every news channel in Central Florida. Missing person flyers with Jennifer's smiling photo, papered street poles and shop windows, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing her face. The community really rallied. People were on horseback searching for her. There were search dogs involved, and even helicopters scoured the area. So it was a heartwarming show of support, yet there was no trace of Jennifer. Every search came up empty. Now, one early clue did emerge from a neighbor. A resident of Jennifer's condo complex reported seeing something on the morning of January 24th that, in hindsight, was chilling. The neighbor said that around 7:40 that morning, they saw Jennifer's black Chevy Malibu hurriedly pull out of the parking lot and drive away. Now, this would have been roughly the time that Jennifer usually left for work. The witness couldn't see who was driving or if Jennifer was even in the car. They just noted that the car was speeding out, leaving the complex. But that detail is critical because it suggests that Jennifer did leave or was taken from her condo by about 7:40 that morning in her own vehicle. So it was the first solid piece of the timeline that Jennifer's car was on the move that morning. If she was driving it, something must have happened after that point. If someone else was driving, it obviously meant Jennifer was likely already in trouble by then. Either way, this clue narrowed the window of time for her disappearance to those early morning hours, not long after she locked her door. For 2 days, Jennifer and her Chevy Malibu were both missing, but on January 26th, 2 days after Jennifer vanished, a major break occurred when Jennifer's car was found. A tenant at an apartment complex called Huntington on the Green, which is about a mile down the road from Jennifer's condo, had seen news reports describing the missing black Malibu. They spotted a similar-looking car abandoned in a guest parking spot at their complex. So acting on a hunch, they notified the police, and sure enough, the license plate matched Jennifer's car. Investigators and the Kessie family rushed to that location, praying that this would finally provide answers, or better yet, that Jennifer herself might be nearby. Now, as it turned out, the discovery of the car would only deepen the mystery, but it also yielded the most tantalizing clues in the case, including the now infamous CCTV footage of an unknown person, which I'll get to in just a second. Now, the car appeared to have been left in a fairly ordinary manner. It wasn't crashed, it wasn't just haphazardly parked and abandoned. It was parked neatly in a guest parking spot as if whoever drove it was not in a panicked rush. Inside, the car was unexpectedly clean and normal. Crime scene techs found nothing obviously broken or disturbed. There was no blood, no obvious sign of a struggle. Notably, there was nothing of major value missing. In fact, some of Jennifer's personal items were still inside the car, such as a cell phone charger and some clothes or sandals on the floorboard. However, noticeably absent were Jennifer's primary cell phone and her purse, which have never been found to this day. The car's condition immediately raised suspicion that it might have been wiped down by whoever had taken it. Now, investigators reported that there were no usable fingerprints or DNA recovered from the interior, which is an oddly pristine result. It was almost too clean, as one detective added, implying that someone may have deliberately cleaned or handled the car in a way to avoid leaving trace evidence. If Jennifer had been attacked or transported in her own car, the perpetrator had been very careful or just incredibly lucky in leaving no forensic trail behind. While forensic evidence from inside the Malibu was limited, evidence on the outside of the car hinted at a violent encounter. So when the Kessie family finally obtained high-resolution photos of the car years later, they noticed what looked like handprints and drag marks on the hood of the black Malibu. Her dad, Drew, described it like this, saying, quote, "It looked like someone was thrown down on top of the hood, arms spread out, and then dragged off. You can almost see fingers sliding down the hood," end quote. So in other words, the dust on the hood had just been disturbed in a pattern consistent with an individual's body or hands skidding across it. and adding weight to this, an analysis noted a layer of fine dust on the hood, which was likely from the ongoing construction at Jennifer's condo complex, which suggests that the car had been near the construction area when a struggle on the hood occurred. Now, the presence of that specific dust implies the altercation might have happened right outside of Jennifer's condo before the car was driven away. Later, an Orlando police detective and the Cassie's private investigator would publicly share those photos, believing that they show signs of a struggle that could be key to the case. Now, additionally, at least one witness reported seeing Jennifer's car driving erratically near the exit of Mosaic at Millennia on the morning that she disappeared. And this witness, who came forward later, said, quote, "The car was moving erratically. It looked as though two people were fighting over the steering wheel," end quote. And that account aligns pretty well with the theory that Jennifer might have been attacked in or around her car just as she was leaving for work, possibly struggling with her abductor even as the car moved. But remember, the witness didn't describe actually seeing Jennifer in the car. So I think when she describes seeing the car moving, like there's somebody fighting over the steering wheel, it might have just been that the car was moving in such a way that it made her think that, rather than her actually see somebody fighting over the steering wheel. So I just want to make that distinction so that it's not confusing. But the location where Jennifer's Malibu was found turned out to offer the biggest clue of the entire case. Huntington on the Green had a surveillance camera overlooking the area where the car was parked. So naturally, detectives pulled the security video, hoping it would show who had left Jennifer's car there. And indeed, it did, sort of. The footage, which has since been broadcast countless times, shows that around noon on January 24th, hours after Jennifer was last heard from, an unknown individual drove her car into that parking lot. The person parked the car, sat in it for about 30 seconds, maybe wiping it down or even just composing themselves, then casually exited and walked away down the sidewalk. They never once looked back at the car, and the demeanor of this person is really striking because nothing about their behavior screams panic or haste. If you didn't know any better, you would just think that this was someone parking a car and heading home from work. The individual walked away in the direction of the main road, which, like I mentioned earlier, leads back towards Jennifer's condo, only like a mile away. Obviously, for investigators, seeing this person on video was a huge break. At last, a potential suspect, or at least a critical witness. But in a cruel twist of fate, identifying them proved nearly impossible. This surveillance system was not a normal video camera. It was an older model that snapped still images only once every 3 seconds. And in every single frame that captured the person, some part of their body was obscured by the tall black iron fence that surrounded the pool area. In fact, the fence's vertical bars lined up perfectly to block the person's face in every single shot. It's almost as if this was done intentionally by fate, truly just a very maddening coincidence. Because of all of this, though, all the footage revealed was a blurry figure in what looked like maybe white work clothes, like maybe a painter or a construction worker of some sort, calmly walking away. And the media would later dub this as the phantom figure or the unidentified person of interest behind the gate. Desperate to pull any detail from the video, investigators brought in NASA and other experts to enhance the footage. The FBI also analyzed the suspect's body proportions and gait. By having people of known heights walk the same route, they estimated that the individual was relatively short, approximately 5'3 to 5'5, and the person's shoes were also noted as looking large relative to their height, so some people have commented that the feet looked like someone wearing large work boots. To Jennifer's family and many investigators, this was a significant clue. Could one of the workers have been involved in Jennifer's disappearance? Because remember, her condo complex was undergoing renovations at the time. To Drew Kessie, seeing that grainy figure felt like confirmation. He said, quote, "In my mind, it was, that person took my daughter. How fast can we find that person?" End quote. Now, unfortunately, despite these efforts, the video could not reveal the person's face or identity. The police department and FBI circulated the few images to the public, hoping that someone might recognize the clothing or the walk, but there were no solid tips that came in. The phantom on tape, still to this day, remains nameless. And it's hard not to imagine how close this came to being solved right then. If only that camera had captured a clear shot just a second earlier or later. So it was another agonizing near miss for the investigation. It's almost like the stars had to align for this case to become the mystery that it is. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out for more new to you styles. I will admit I was a little skeptical at first because I'm not the type of person who dresses up very often, but you guys, this is actually so perfect and I'm genuinely so excited about this new membership with Armoire. And I want to tell you what the process was like for me. I got onto their website and I mean, there were so much to choose from. I ended up choosing 6 items and I was kind of like, we'll see what happens, you know, not sure how they were going to arrive, if they were going to be like noticeably used or what. But listen, 2 days after I placed my like case order, it showed up on my doorstep. Everything was like, when I pulled it out of the bag, everything was neatly folded and then tied up in this really pretty little bow. And I got so excited. I'm actually taking a trip to Dallas with my daughter soon, so I'm gonna wear an outfit for that. Austin and I are gonna go to a Teddy Swims concert, so I got an outfit for that. I'm like, you guys, I'm so excited about this because everything showed up in great condition. I mean, I think it looks brand new. And it's $900 worth of clothes that I'm renting for less than $100. And the best part for me is that I can just send it back. I don't typically dress up that often, but this is so perfect for like the random occasions that I do dress up without having to go and like splurge on an entire new outfit that I might only wear once. I will be honest, I feel guilty that over half of my closet has only been worn once, if at all. And there are even a few items that are going to Goodwill with the tags on them. So I love being on trend and having new things to wear, but I hate the waste that I'm creating when I do that, right? So Armoire allows me to rent these high quality designer clothes for any occasion and then just send it back. If you've got a wedding or a job interview or just like anything that you just want to kind of dress up a little bit. But the nice thing is they also have athleisure. So I got this really cute Kate Spade anorak jacket that I can wear with like a pair of leggings, and it just kind of makes you feel a little more dressed up while you're still dressed down. I also got some really cool floral wide leg pants from Steve Madden with this really cute denim halter like front vest top to go with it. And just in case that doesn't work out, I got another option too to go with the pants, and then I can have like kind of 2 outfits in one. You guys, I cannot tell you enough how excited I am about this. And right now my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Please try Armoire today. And if you do, tag me in the pictures of your outfits so I can get some inspiration and kind of see what y'all are getting. But this is so fun. I'm really, really excited about this. Thanks again to Armoire for sponsoring today's episode. And now back to the story.
Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair. Wayfair, every style, every home.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
In the first days of the investigation, aside from the car and the CCTV, there were several missteps and challenges that also became apparent. One issue was that Jennifer's condo complex had no security cameras at all covering the parking lot or hallways, only a human security guard at the gate. That guard's logbook for visitors, when checked, turned out to be incomplete and unreliable. So there was no video of Jennifer in her own parking area. There's no solid record of any visitors or workers coming in that morning. And this was another just frustrating gap. Making matters worse, the Kesey family soon learned that a full set of master keys to the Mosaic condos had been stolen about a month before Jennifer disappeared. So that meant whoever took those keys could potentially access any unit in the complex. Jennifer knew about this theft, and it was a point of concern. She even mentioned to her parents that maintenance workers had been in her unit recently to do some repairs and painting, and that she always stayed on the phone with someone while they were there, just as a precaution. The missing master key, though, raises a chilling possibility. Could someone have made a copy and used it to enter her condo either that Monday night or Tuesday morning? Orlando police did not find signs of forced entry at Jennifer's condo, which is consistent with either Jennifer letting someone in or someone entering with a key. So it's an unsettling thought that a person with ill intent might have had easy access to her house. Another significant issue was the contamination of the crime scene. When Jennifer's family and friends entered her condo on January 24th looking for clues, they had inadvertently disturbed potential evidence. They had tidied up a bit, they had touched doorknobs, went through papers, all normal things that somebody would do to see if there was something amiss. But by the time police treated the condo as a possible abduction scene, many people had been through it. Fingerprints, trace DNA, or other evidence that wasn't obvious may have been smeared or lost in those crucial early hours. So this was no one's fault per se. Like, her loved ones had no reason initially to treat her home as off limits, but in hindsight, it deprived investigators of a pristine scene to examine. The Orlando Police Department would later face criticism for not immediately roping off the condo or doing more thorough forensics on day one. Despite these setbacks, law enforcement and the Kesey family continued pressing forward. In the weeks and months after Jennifer vanished, thousands of tips poured in. The case got national media attention. Jennifer's story was featured on shows like Nancy Grace and 48 Hours. The family offered a $15,000 reward, later increased for any information. Tips ranged from alleged sightings of Jennifer to vague psychic visions, but one by one, they led nowhere concrete. As 2006 wore on with no sign of Jennifer and no arrests, frustrations mounted. The Orlando police maintained the case was active, but progress seemed to stall. Jennifer's loved ones grew increasingly concerned that some leads might have been missed or not fully pursued by the overwhelmed detectives. And indeed, one crucial lead, a name, was sitting quietly in a case file, not receiving the attention that it perhaps warranted at first. And that name was Chino. From the very start, investigators looked closely at the people in Jennifer's life and immediate environment for potential suspects. Naturally, Rob, her boyfriend, was thoroughly investigated. Phone records and witnesses confirmed that he was in South Florida, more than 200 miles away, when Jennifer vanished, and there was no evidence pointing to him in any case. Her family members were likewise ruled out. Attention then turned to other individuals around Jennifer, especially at her condo complex, since that's where she was last seen. Given the hints from that surveillance footage, the work clothes wearing short figure, and the circumstances at Mosaic at Millennia, the construction workers and maintenance staff at the complex became a focal point. one name kept popping up in discussion, both due to circumstance and later due to a tip. A maintenance worker known as Chino. Chino, his real name has not been released publicly, but Chino had done repair work inside Jennifer's condo just about 1 week before she disappeared. He was employed by the complex's maintenance crew at the time, and to family and police, that alone made him a person of interest. He was familiar with Jennifer and her unit's layout, and possibly even knew her routine. But there was more. About a week after Jennifer went missing, an anonymous crime line tip came in suggesting that Chino could be involved. It's unclear what information or allegation that tip contained, but it was significant enough that later on, a detective was surprised that it hadn't been followed up on sooner. In any case, Chino wasn't immediately apprehended, perhaps because by the time the tip surfaced, Chino was no longer around the complex. In fact, by 2008, Chino was serving time in prison for an unrelated charge, a statutory rape case that happened 2 years after Jennifer's disappearance. This made it easier for law enforcement to find and question him without tiptoeing around legal barriers. And in 2009, OPD Detective Joel Wright interviewed Chino in prison with the conversation recorded. During this interview, Chino admitted that he remembered Jennifer having been in her condo to fix something shortly before she vanished, and claimed that she was friendly and nothing unusual happened during that job. When Detective Wright confronted him with the surveillance images, noting that the person was dressed like a maintenance or construction worker, Chino acknowledged the resemblance in attire, but he flatly denied that the figure was him. And it is crucial to say that some of Chino's physical attributes did not match the phantom figure. Chino is about 5'9", significantly taller than the roughly 5'3" to 5'5" height estimate from that CCTV. So if the CCTV height analysis is accurate, that would seem to rule him out as the person who parked Jennifer's car. And Chino also agreed to take a polygraph test, which he reportedly passed, and was generally cooperative during the questioning. On camera, he actually asserted, "Everybody knows for a fact I had nothing to do with Jennifer Kessie." However, when pressed by Detective Wright about where he was on the morning of January 24th, Chino cut the interview short, saying, quote, "I don't have to answer any more questions," end quote. And that refusal to account for his whereabouts just left an uneasy feeling. Chino was in prison for something else at the time of the interview, so it's possible he just didn't want to discuss any prior bad acts or association, but still, the lack of a clear alibi or explanation for that morning didn't exactly dispel suspicions. Over the years, anecdotal reports about Chino added to the cloud of doubt. One woman who had lived at Mosaic at Millennia recalled that around 9 months after Jennifer disappeared, Chino, who was still living and working there at the time, like he wasn't living at the condo complex, but obviously in the area, but he had abruptly moved out in the middle of the night. At the time, she didn't think much of him, but in hindsight, the sudden departure did seem odd. Another female resident reported that Chino had a habit of approaching her in the parking lot at night and that he made her uncomfortable with his comments or behavior. These stories, while not proof of anything, painted a picture of a man who could be unsettling to women around him. And let's not forget, he's in prison for a rape charge. So the Kessie's family private investigators certainly took notice of Chino. In fact, Drew has said pointedly that Chino should expect to hear from them. The family's team did speak with Chino again in more recent years, but whatever came of those conversations has not been made public. And as of now, Chino has never been charged in connection with Jennifer's case, and he maintains his innocence. He remains, however, a significant person of interest in the eyes of many who follow this case. Aside from Chino, detectives did look at many others in Jennifer's orbit. All friends, ex-boyfriends, co-workers, anyone who knew Jennifer was questioned and cleared. None had any motive or evidence against them, and attention kept circling back to the Mosaic at Millennia complex and the workers there. Early on, Jennifer's brother, Logan, even took it upon himself to talk with some of the construction guys at the complex in the days after the disappearance. Logan later said that he found them uncooperative and got a gut feeling that someone knew something. But unfortunately, because many of those laborers were transient or day workers, by the time police tried to formally interview them, a lot of them had vanished. Some were undocumented immigrants who likely fled to avoid any scrutiny from law enforcement. Others simply moved on to other job sites as the condo renovations wrapped up. But this was a huge hurdle. Dozens of potential witnesses or suspects scattered with no easy way to track them down. Those who were found and interviewed often spoke little English or couldn't provide useful information, so it was a dead end in many respects. Still, years later, the Kesey family hired an investigator, Michael Torretta, and Michael dug back into this angle and uncovered something really startling. At the time Jennifer disappeared, as many as 10 construction workers were living in an empty apartment across the hall from Jennifer's unit. Essentially, a group of workers had a makeshift quarters right next door to her. It's easy to imagine how closely they might have observed Jennifer's comings and goings. And Michael formulated a theory, which we'll explore in just a second, but that one or more of those men abducted Jennifer as she walked out her door on January 24th, possibly dragging her into that empty unit to subdue her. Scent dogs were eventually brought into that vacant property years later, but they did not find any trace of Jennifer. If anything did happen there, any evidence was long gone. By the end of 2006 and into 2007, despite a lot of legwork, police had not named any official suspects. They had persons of interest, like some of those workers and Chino and possibly others whose names just haven't been revealed, but no arrests were ever made. The case was painfully stagnant in terms of public progress, and it was clear that Jennifer had likely been the victim of a crime, most likely an abduction, but by whom and why still just remained elusive. Investigators and the Kesey family were left with a handful of clues: the car, the CCTV images, the evidence of a struggle, and a general consensus that the answer lay close to Jennifer's home. Over the years, several theories have been proposed to explain what might have happened to Jennifer. So one of the first ones, one of the earliest and strongest theories, is that Jennifer was abducted by someone working at or living near her condo. And the rationale is really straightforward. There were a lot of construction workers on site. Mosaic was undergoing a conversion from apartments to condos in 2006. And many of those workers were unsupervised, transient, and even, like I said, living in some of the empty units in the complex. And Jennifer had actually voiced discomfort about this situation to her family, saying that, you know, there were a lot of workers there that would just stop and stare at her when she would walk by. And now it's important to note that other women in the complex also reported similar experiences, like catcalls and leering, and a general sense that they were being watched by some of the laborers. Jennifer was vigilant enough that whenever workers came into her condo, she would stay on the phone with someone until they left, and this indicates that she felt uneasy, like there was a potential threat. The next theory, of course, is Chino. Now, Chino had proximity, opportunity, and a possible motive if he had an attraction to Jennifer or anger towards her that no one else knew of. He also has not provided an alibi for that morning, at least publicly, which leaves a big question mark. And the fact that he was serving prison time for rape insists that he has a predatory side to him. But perhaps most telling, the Kesey family's investigators have not cleared Chino. They still consider him someone who might know more than he's actually saying. Now, the weaknesses in this theory, of course, are that the CCTV figure's height is a big discrepancy. 5'9 to 5'4, that's a pretty big discrepancy, unless the height analysis was wrong. But there was also no physical or forensic evidence that tied Chino to anything. His DNA was not found, as far as we know. No fingerprints, no witnesses claiming to see him with Jennifer. So if he did it, he's either very lucky or very cunning to leave no trace. Chino also voluntarily took that lie detector test and passed, which, you know, some people believe in the polygraphs, some people don't, which is probably why they're not permissible in the court of law, but Chino is just one of those characters that remains under a cloud of suspicion in the public's mind, and the case against him is more intuitive than factual at this stage. Now, another theory, of course, is that the abduction was just by a stranger and possibly a trafficking scenario, which would mean that this was totally random. Orlando is a large city with a lot of tourists and transient populations, and sadly, Florida in general has been known to have issues with human trafficking and opportunistic crimes. So could it be that Jennifer, a young, attractive woman was targeted by traffickers or a lone predator who was trolling for a victim. Jennifer's father, Drew, has considered this to be a possibility. In one interview, he speculated that maybe someone pointed Jennifer out in advance. For instance, a malicious actor in her vicinity, like a worker or acquaintance with a debt or gang initiation. Now, this would be a conspiracy-type scenario where Jennifer was essentially kidnapped to be sold or harmed elsewhere. Florida's highways and proximity to ports can facilitate moving victims, and it's a horrifying thought, but I don't know. I personally think this is less likely. And the thing is like, I believe in human trafficking. I know that it's real. And we just covered Amy Bradley's story, which, you know, I think is a very real possibility in that case. But if Jennifer was abducted into sex trafficking, one grim explanation for the lack of any trace is that she could have been taken out of the area very quickly, possibly out of the country. Orlando has a huge tourist population and unfortunately also a shadow side where people can just vanish into illicit networks. Another possibility under the stranger abduction umbrella is that there was a carjacking or maybe a robbery gone wrong, that perhaps someone not from Mosaic attempted to steal Jennifer's car in the parking lot that morning, not expecting her to fight back. And if she fought back, things could have just escalated. However, robbery seems a lot less likely because none of her valuables were used or turned up. Like, her credit cards were never used. Her car wasn't stripped or sold. It was just dumped, and only like hours after the abduction. And her condo was not burglarized. So it just suggests that the motive was more personal than financial. In 2016, 10 years after Jennifer disappeared, she was legally declared deceased by the state of Florida. And this was just a technical move often done at the decade mark for missing persons so that families can deal with the legal matters like property and insurance. I believe the same was done in Amy's case. And it did not change the Kessie family's belief that Jennifer could still be alive, nor has it for the Bradleys. But it did allow them to make a bold decision to take ownership of the investigation files. By 2018, fed up with the OPD's lack of progress, the Kessies sued the Orlando Police Department and the City of Orlando for Jennifer's case records. Now, this was an unprecedented step. Essentially, the family was saying, if you're not solving it, let us try. And after some legal wrangling, a deal was struck. OPD's chief agreed to release all 16,000 pages of records and dozens of hours of video to the family, on the condition that OPD would officially close their active investigation. So in other words, OPD handed over the torch and charged the Kessies over $18,000 in copying fees to do so. The family accepted this. They wanted that torch. And in 2019, they finally received the massive trove of case files. The Kessies then assembled their own dream team of retired law enforcement, former detectives, FBI agents, private investigators, all with the singular goal of re-examining everything with fresh eyes. Michael Toretta, the PI that I told you about earlier, was also among them, and they spent months poring over documents, evidence logs, interview transcripts, essentially rebuilding the case from scratch. Right away, they found things that had slipped through the cracks. For instance, that crime line tip about Chino had been filed away early on and seemingly never aggressively followed until Detective Wright stumbled on it later. There were leads that were never followed up on and people that were interviewed. Michael commented, quote, "There's never been one quarterback on this case. A lot of information that could have been developed wasn't in the most critical hours," end quote. And that just validated that the family's instincts that the OPD over the years had dropped the ball in various ways was true. The new team set out to fix that, conducting new interviews, reanalyzing evidence with modern technology, and generating new avenues. They even went back to old witnesses to ask fresh questions. This private investigation effort was and still is funded by the Kessie family's own money and donations. By 2019, the family had spent over $500,000, $500,000 in their fight to find Jennifer. They set up a GoFundMe to continue raising funds for ongoing investigative work. And then in late 2022, after building a cooperative relationship with Florida state authorities, the Kessies convinced the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FDLE, to take on Jennifer's case as a cold case review. In November of 2022, FDLE formally took over as the lead agency on the investigation, and this was a major shift. For the first time in 16 years, Orlando PD was not in charge. Frankly, OPD had closed it on their end anyway, but FDLE's cold case unit has access to more advanced resources, including some cutting-edge forensic labs. They also had the benefit of all the groundwork that the Kesey family's team had done. The family handed over their findings and theories, essentially teaming up with FDLE. Understandably, Drew and Joyce had mixed feelings. They were used to being in the loop on every discovery, and now they had to kind of step back and let FDLE work largely in secret, but they were hopeful that real progress could finally be made. In late 2023, that hope seemed to be validated. FDLE officials informed the Kesey family that they no longer consider Jennifer's case to be cold. They said it is very much active and ongoing with new developments. Investigators have reportedly recovered new DNA evidence and have used the family's research to narrow down a list of prime persons of interest. Now, this was the first encouraging news in many years. Drew Kesey received a phone call with these updates and then later shared that FDLE truly believes they are getting somewhere. Now, FDLE has not publicly disclosed what the new DNA evidence is. It could be touch DNA from Jennifer's car or condo that's finally been tested with modern techniques, or something retrieved from evidence that OPD might have stored. They also haven't said who is on that short list of people of interest. That, of course, remains confidential as it is an ongoing investigation, but it does strongly suggest that behind the scenes, they may be closing in on someone. And God, I hope that's the case. Throughout this journey, the Kesey's family's strength has been nothing short of remarkable. I mean, they have never, ever given up. And I would never expect a family to give up. But they have never stopped advocating for Jennifer. Every January, they post updates or hold gatherings to honor her and remind the world that she is still missing. On the 19th anniversary, which was just this past January, the family wrote, quote, "How can a missing persons case with such awareness not produce even a direction 19 years later is inconceivable yet very true. No, time does not heal all wounds, but we still stay strong and fight the fight that needs to be fought for Jennifer's sake," end quote. They reject the notion of closure without having any answers. As Joyce Kesey has said, time passing doesn't make it hurt less. If anything, it just makes the absence even harder. As of today, FDLE is actively working on the case alongside the Kesey's team. The case is officially not cold. There is new DNA evidence being analyzed, possibly even as I record this. And I just hope that with persistence, modern science, and maybe a dose of luck for once for this case, this mystery will soon be solved. The ultimate goal is that one day I can update this story with an ending, one that finds Jennifer and delivers justice to whoever is responsible for her disappearance. Until then, we continue to share her story, remember her vibrant life, and hold on to faith that the truth is out there and it will soon be revealed. Now, if you have any information on the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey, please speak up. The clock has been ticking for 19 years, but it's never too late to do the right thing. Thank you so much for listening to Jennifer's story. It's obviously one that really underscores the importance of community vigilance and the enduring power of a family's love. So stay safe, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair.
Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.